for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. George Gershwin once said, "I frequently hear music in the heart of noise." Writer Garrett Kaiser has written a book exploring the meaning of noise through history, across cultures, and in our own backyards. He joins me in the studio to talk about what noise can reveal about our most vital social issues. The title of his new book is "The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want." We'll take your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, Garrett. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Before we even opened the program, you and I were talking about noise in restaurants. I choose my restaurant certainly on the basis of good food, but even more importantly, on the basis of how loud that restaurant is, how noisy it is. Americans seem to have gotten noisier over the years. Would you agree?
I think possibly, and in fact, the Canadian Soundscape Association some years ago estimated that over the past 30 years, the average sound of an animated American conversation has risen by a measurable amount.
Isn't that interesting? Explain your title, "The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want."
Well, noise is most often defined, some would say maybe not most suitably defined, as unwanted sound. And I work with that definition in the book and suggest a few others. But what I wanted to suggest with my title is that noise is a window for understanding some of the paradoxes and contradictions of being human. So I took the unwanted sound, and then I asked, well, what's making that unwanted sound? And often it's things that we want, or at least in which our lives are fully invested, so that when we call a sound a noise, we're making a statement, but we're also implying a question about the way we live.
For example, in South Africa, as the games went on, you heard this loud noise in the background. Take that as an example of what you're writing about.
Well, it's an excellent example, and I just have to tell your listeners that because I don't have television and because I only have dial-up internet, I heard the vuvuzela for the first time in your studio in the introduction to this interview. I'd read about it before. It strikes me as a very interesting and a curious noise issue in all kinds of ways, and typical of many noise issues. It strikes me as curious, first of all, because a lot of the complaints about the vuvuzela are coming from people who have made a lot of noise in getting to the place where they're able to complain about it. They have, many of them, flown hundreds or thousands of miles over hundreds and thousands of people to enjoy the privilege of watching these games, and are upset, and I'm not saying they're foolish to be upset about this plastic horn. The other thing that I find interesting about this is the people who are mentioned, that is, the people who are taken into account when that horn is discussed. We talk about the players. We talk about the coaches. We talk about the audience in the stands, whether they're blowing vuvuzelas or holding their ears, and about their rights, prerogatives, preferences. We talk about the people at home watching the event on their widescreen TVs. But rarely do we hear a mention of the workers in that stadium who sweep between the bleachers, who clear the fields, who pump up the balls, and who are being exposed to that sound, which is above the levels that can cause hearing loss, who are exposed to that sound, and hearing loss is a leading, the leading occupational hazard worldwide. And we don't hear a great deal about them. In some ways, I think the vuvuzela is not only a noise, but the conversation about it functions like a noise in that it drowns out other concerns. So it becomes a case of, are you for vuvuzelas, in which case perhaps you're certifying your rectitude as a multiculturalist, or are you against vuvuzelas? What I'm against is people being pushed out of their homes in order to make way for a sporting event. And I won't use a word like against. Let me just say I have questions about the amount of money spent on such an event in a developing nation in which there are many kids who are not going to play soccer even on a decent field.
Well, it's interesting that you say that noise is a weak issue because it disproportionately affects the weak, the poor, the laborers, the soldiers, prisoners, children, and those with a sense of imposed helplessness, that they, without power, have more noise in their lives than perhaps I do as I make my selection to go to a quiet restaurant when I can hear my husband, my friends talk.
Absolutely. And that's been demonstrated in many studies. And really, it can be demonstrated to most people by simple observation. To be fair, I want to say that noise probably is a weak issue relative to some other issues. If you ask me, you know, if the government has only a dime to spend, should it spend it on global climate change or should it spend it on noise? I'm going to vote for option one, but adding the footnote that noise also can reveal a lot about global climate change, but it also reveals how we get to big problems like that by ignoring things, people, communities, creatures, issues that we dismiss as weak in our hurry to get to some larger agenda, usually tripping over a very large problem on the way.
Garrett Kaiser, his book about noise is titled The Unwanted Sound of Everything. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I left off the last two words in that title, the unwanted sound of everything we want. I look forward to hearing from you, so do give us a call. We are learning more and more about the ways in which noise is harmful to our health. It's not only that it may affect our hearing, but indeed could affect our whole bodily function.
Yes, and research has been ongoing for a number of decades on this subject. It took a major hit in the U.S. when the EPA's Office of Noise Abatement and Control was closed in the early 80s, but research continues in this country and in others, and it reveals that noise is a stressor and that noise probably elevates blood pressure, elevates certain stress hormones, may have a negative influence on our immune system. A recent study showed that even noise that didn't wake you could elevate your blood pressure, and that the louder the noise, the more it elevated the pressure, which, of course, refuted the idea that you had to be annoyed in order to be stressed. Noise also, of course, interferes with sleep, and there are health problems associated with that. There's something like 60 million people in the United States who have various levels of sleep difficulty. And noise also has been shown in the lab to interfere with what we might call social health. The study is over 30 years old that showed people less likely to help someone in a cast having difficulty next to a lawnmower, that subjects with noise gave lower raises to fictitious employees, that people exposed to noise in a controlled experiment were more likely to administer fictitious electric shocks to other people than people in a quiet environment.
You know, I think you and I share a habit going back to childhood in that I can remember my mother especially saying to me, "Keep your voice down." And out on the playing field, on the baseball field, on the tennis court, I was always the loudest one there. Were you the same?
Well, I was told to keep my voice down. I'm not sure that I was always the loudest one there.
Sometimes. I was.
But it's interesting because, and I don't know your background, of course, but this opens up another whole interesting dimension.
About which we will talk after a short break. The book is titled "The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want." It's a book about noise by Garrett Kaiser. Short break. We'll be right back. And just before the break, Garrett Kaiser and I were talking about childhood noise and the fact that my mother, and I gather his as well, told him to keep his voice down. And so he has ended up writing a book about noise. It's titled "The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want." Now, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that in that anecdote, you open yet another door in this fascinating subject. I assume our mothers told us to be to keep our voices down because they believed in civility. Perhaps they told us because we were children and children should be more often seen than heard. And they might have told you, although I wouldn't presume to speak for your parents, because you were a girl. And when you study noise and silence, the flip side of people being oppressed by noise, drowned out by the noise of others, is people who have been silenced. And you can look in literature and history and find loads of examples of that. Folk tales celebrating the silence of obedient wives, even as their husbands subject them to terrible tests. A medieval law in England that required all Jewish services be said in submissa voca, and I may be mispronouncing the Latin, but in a low voice so as not to offend Christian sensibilities.
And, of course, the Industrial Revolution changed the whole landscape of noise, did it not?
It did. I sometimes think when I was researching the Industrial Revolution for the book, I found myself thinking of science fiction movies and novels like H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds, when the Martians suddenly appear with these incredible machines. And I wonder if the Earthlings were any more shocked in these, or could be any more shocked by something like that as perhaps some were, and are today when they migrate to industrial centers in the developing world, by the change in the sonic environment, by sounds that literally, before the Industrial Revolution, song and work were tied together. In medieval Wales, a plowing team consisted traditionally of two men, one man who held the reins on the ox and the handles of the plow, and another who walked at the head of the ox and sang to it. And that dimension was eliminated, first of all, in the factory workplace, and then as the farm began to function more like a factory, it was eliminated there as well.
So noise simply had a way of growing along with our developing into less human-focused activities and more machine-focused activities.
I would agree with that in general, yes. In fact, I would agree emphatically. With perhaps a few qualifications. And one is that the Industrial Revolution and some of the technical know-how that drove it also created the knowledge base for quieting certain sounds, certain noises. For instance, airplanes have been quieted a great deal mm-hmm. over what they were in the 60s. The problem is that we have more of them in the air. First-hand accounts of the sounds of iron-shod horses' hooves on cobblestone streets indicated that that could be quite a racket, as was a blacksmith's hammer. Especially if you were a blacksmith, that repeated exposure to that explosive, impulsive noise reduce the hearing of many of them. But in general, yes, the Industrial Revolution made things louder.
What about the invention of the electric light?
The invention of the electric light, in my book, I have a little fun postulating what invention might get first prize for contributing the most noise to the world. And I cast a vote, somewhat with tongue-in-cheek, but seriously also for the electric light, because what it did was it colonized the night, the sonic environment of the night. Now the purposeful, work-oriented, goal-driven activities of the day could be extended into the night, much the same way that some of our inventions now make it so that we're really never out of the reach of certain communication devices.
It's interesting because here's an email from Elizabeth. She's in Peterborough, New Hampshire. She says, I climbed a mountain with my son one late weekday afternoon. We sat down for a rest on the way up. Alone on the trail, both of us amazed by the silence. No traffic sounds, no wind, not even buzzing insects. Then, just last week, my husband and I woke up in the middle of the night because we think of the silence. We didn't speak to each other during the night, but the next morning, both of us remarked, we were almost spooked by the silence of that particular night. No humming of the water heater or the refrigerator, no insects, the air still. These two incidents made me wonder, How many of us actually experience real silence anymore?
Probably fewer and fewer of us, and most of us, I think, don't even want to experience pure silence for any length of time, because pure silence is a scary thing, just like absolute noise might be a scary thing. I don't see noise so much as the enemy of silence as I see it as the opposite of silence and the enemy of the smaller everyday sounds that happen in between. But silence, or simply natural quiet, is becoming a rarer thing as the country fills up. And people in the Park Service have actually discovered that many visitors to the parks, which traditionally have been about seeing great visual monuments, are wanting natural silence. They're coming to the parks for that.
And, of course, you've got Mayor Bloomberg in New York revising his noise code for the city. What's happening there?
Well, in 2007, of course, the work began several years prior to that. New York City engaged in a thoroughgoing revision of its noise code, the first revision in 30 years. Noise was the number one complaint among New Yorkers at the beginning of the 20th century, and it remains close to that today. And the noise code was an attempt to quiet the city. It imposed fines on things like excessive honking of horns. It was written to impose some more stringent guidelines on construction activities, although the rubrics pertaining to construction were written with the advice of people who work in the construction business. And in some cases, they found that this seemingly intractable problem can sometimes be helped by, you know, a few common sense solutions. Heavier plywood around construction sites. They even developed or found someone who had developed a jacket, a sound mitigating jacket to put on jacket hammers. I don't know whether I'm just a suggestible person, but I've noticed a change in New York since the code. Others tell me there is no change. The one thing the code doesn't address, however, is neighbor noise, which is a major cause of noise annoyance.
But, you know, I was in New York recently, and I noticed a change in terms most especially of horns. Fewer automobiles, fewer taxis using those horns. And I found myself wondering whether that wasn't because of new regulations about how frequently and how much you could use your horn. Is there any research that shows that children who are exposed to loud noises have more difficulty socially as they grow up and might be more inclined toward less than social behavior?
Yes, there is lots of research, and children are probably about 15 decibels more sensitive to acoustic stimuli than adults are. And the effect of noise on children can begin even in a neonatal unit. When preemies are born, a lot of monitoring equipment is necessary to keep track of them. There's some studies to suggest that the noise of that equipment may lead to attention deficits later in life. Children exposed to noise not only in school, and we knew that as early as the 70s, but even to noisy in noisy homes, and even when adjustment is made for other socio and economic factors, tend to do less well in school. And students who have more trouble in school are more affected by noise.
You live in northeastern Vermont.
Yes.
Is it quiet?
It's quiet most of the time. It's quiet most of the time. I live in a town or outside of a town with a total population of 1,000 people. But, you know, I've been awakened in the night by coon dogs who've treed a raccoon not far from my house. The thing about a quieter ambient is it makes any sound of some volume especially noticeable.
Oh, boy.
Because it stands out all the more. I think I probably notice traffic noise maybe on my dirt road more than some people might on a more traveled. But there's certainly noise in the rural environment, much of it occupational noise. Two of the major ways of earning a living in my community are with logging and farming, and both involve loud machinery. And I remember when I first moved to northeastern Vermont, noticing that many of the men I spoke to seemed to speak very loudly. And I wondered, you know, what was going on? Was this some cultural thing or whatever? And my wife, who's a speech pathologist, said, I think some of them are hard of hearing.
Hmm.
And probably from the machines they've used.
Garrett Kaiser, his new book is titled The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Pontiac, Michigan. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning. I want to make a comment on an observation. It seems like the soundtracks on movies and television shows, the music is much louder than the talking more and more. It just seems like really hard to hear the dialect of the talking on these programs. Is that something they're doing to try and get people that think they're getting our attention? But we're there to listen to the story, you know?
What do you think, Garrett?
Oh, most definitely. And the reasons for it, the use of it is relatively recent, but the reasons for it go back millions of years. We evolved as creatures who respond to noise. With an increase of stress hormones, with an increase of adrenaline. Our ancestors, when they heard a loud sound, the ones who could respond quickly to that survived, and the ones who couldn't were eaten. And we have kept that mechanism in ourselves, and it can be exploited by advertisers, by entertainers. If you go to a gym, you'll also notice that the music is sometimes pumped so loud. And the reason is to stimulate those stress hormones to stimulate that fight or flight response. So when someone tells you, you know, why can't you just get used to a noise? I mean, one of the things they're saying to you is, why can't you just lose 2 or 3 million years of evolution and get over it? Not
and
so easy.
Of course, the other thing there, Ron, is that I've noticed, even on television, that the decibels associated with advertising much, much higher than those with the television program itself. Have you picked up the same thing?
Absolutely. I was wondering, is there any hope that this will change as far as being able to hear what's actually going on in the story?
Most definitely, and I find the hope in your question, because I think when questions like that get asked and people move beyond saying it must be me, and when people express their preferences, I think that it can be changed.
And to just be rather anti-noise here, the louder we speak up about this, perhaps the more they may pay attention. Thanks for calling, Ron. To Dennis in Rochester, New York, you're on the air.
Hello. I am 64 and just had my hearing tested last year and still have the hearing of a five-year-old.
Good for you.
Yes.
Thanks. But I think my hearing's better than my children because they are constantly bombarding their ears with music and other things, and I find when I go to movies now, and even concerts sometimes, I need to bring earplugs just to lower the volume to something comfortable for me. So what I'm wondering about is, as children, lose their hearing even more and more? Is that just going to make for more noise as volumes are turned up to overcompensate for that?
I sure do worry about that, Garrett.
Yes, and it probably will. According to one study right now, 1 in 8 American kids has some noise-induced hearing loss. That means about 5 million children. That is a problem. And your ears being as good as they are is a wonderful thing, and wonderful in the sense of good news for you, and also in the sense of a wonder. A study, again, of some date, it's maybe 30, 40 years old, found that 80-year-olds in the Sudan, in tribes in the Sudan, had better hearing than 40 and 30-year-olds. In the United States.
Garrett Kaiser, his book is titled The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want. It's a book about noise. We are talking about noise in this hour. Your voices are not noise. They're music to my ears.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The era of easy oil is over, says Michael Clare, and we're entering the era of tough oil, in which
the geological formations are unfamiliar, unknown, and where the Earth will behave in unexpected, unforeseen ways.
Michael Clare talks about oil on the next Fresh Air.
And we'll go right back to the phones to Allison in Dallas, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for your show. You're a delight.
Thank you.
I have a problem that it's my dogs are not problem barkers, okay? But I have discovered that a neighbor is using a tool that transmits ultrasound that we can't hear, but it stops the dogs in their tracks, and then just turn into statues. And I talked to the people at the store that sells them, like PetSmart, and he says he thinks it's terrible that their company sells that because he knows that people use them to harass other people's animals.
Garrett, huh? Have you heard about anything of that sort?
I have not.
Huh.
And you can look at it on the Internet. There was an attorney who had a letter that was describing how it opens up a whole can of worms because, I mean, obviously for my dogs, they're urinating and defecating in the house, and, you know, it's terrible. And I want to figure out how to get a group of people together to get something like this out of the stores.
Well, but first and foremost, considering the fact that it's your next door neighbor, have you talked with him or her about this?
For one thing, I talked with the people at the city, and they said, your dogs are not problem barkers. And I know the personality of the person next door.
I see.
So, I understand where she's coming from. And
yeah.
I'm very attentive to my dogs. I don't leave them outside. If they bark, I bring them back in and
right.
all that. But the thing is that it's being used probably more widely than people know.
Hmm.
And it's a really ugly thing because...
Sure.
It's taking away their playtime, their puppy time. It's just heartbreaking to me.
Well, I can certainly understand that. I think dogs are extraordinarily sensitive to sound. If I were you, I would perhaps put your feelings politely into a letter and send that letter to your next-door neighbor without hostility, but just talking about the way your particular dogs are being affected. I'm sure glad it's not my next-door neighbor. Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Aaron, who is actually it's Aaron, who is living in Bogor, Indonesia. He says, I'm an American living in Indonesia, in Jakarta, till just a few days ago. Compared to Jakarta, I find the noisiest locations and circumstances in the U.S. to be negligible. The amount of ambient noise on the streets of Jakarta is incredible. Most of it from vehicles, millions of cats, buses, motorbikes, motorbike cabs. The poorer the vehicle, the poorer the fuel it burns, the louder it is. Amazingly, I found out Indonesians then deliberately buy mufflers for their motorbikes that amplify the sound of the exhaust, making the streets even less tolerable. I'm glad we are not broadcasting today from Indonesia, Garrett.
Yes.
All right, and let's go now to Laurie in Mason, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Hello, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment, and that is that my father is very hard of hearing. He's been giving a hearing aid. However, it's actually created more problems because he is stubborn about it and doesn't wish to wear it and claims, he doesn't have the problem. So what happens is it makes everyone else miserable because the TV is blaring, the radio is blaring, talking to him on the phone is almost impossible. And yet, he says, oh, it's fine, it's fine. And so, although, he has lost some of his hearing, he is in essence creating a problem. And I've met other people who know other people who do this as well. And it's just, as I said, it's just a comment, and I'll take any other comments off the air.
All right, Laurie, thanks for calling.
Well, there is a man that I've spoken with, I mentioned in the book, named Les Blomberg, who runs an organization called the Noise Pollution Clearinghouse, which is online and maybe the best online repository of noise information there is. And Les is fond of saying that every noise dispute reveals a breakdown of community. Certainly the one with the dog device did. And I would not suggest that's what's happening here, but rather that what you're dealing with illustrates how underneath most noise disputes there's a failure or a breakdown in communication. In fairness to your father, it is quite possible that the hearing aid is not helping him. And in some cases, hearing aids do not help those who wear them. But I, too, took care of an elderly person and a relative who had a hearing problem, and I had to wear earplugs when the television was playing in order to work because it was blasting. You could hear it before you entered the house. So I have no easy solution. But if your father has enough hearing to hear you, there is certainly hope.
Now, what would you suggest, going back to the beginning of the program and my concern about noisy neighbors in a restaurant setting, when people no longer talk softly as they once did at a table, concerned about others in the restaurant, but talk at the tops of their lungs? What would you suggest?
In that particular situation, where you're part of a very transitory community, I guess probably the only solution that wouldn't generate more noise, such as getting into a, would be either to ask to have one's table moved or simply to find another restaurant, but being sure to note to the restaurant owner that this was your reason for leaving. And sometimes restaurants are noisy. I went to a bar in Sturgis, South Dakota, during the motorcycle rally that was louder than anything I heard out on the street. And one of the things that happens is it's like an arms race. People start talking louder to be heard above the loud talk. So it just gets louder and louder and louder. And the restaurant owner might look to see what he or she is doing to create that ambience to begin with, possibly by piping in music too loud.
Here's an email from Frank, who says, please explain the connection between age and noise tolerance. I'm 40 years old. I find I'm suddenly missing the quiet forests of my adolescence, which I spent in rural Maine.
Well, many people who are old enough to remember those forest silences miss them. As we get older, we tend to lose some of the higher frequencies of our hearing. As the little hairs on the in our inner ear and our cochlea break or bend and are not restored. And so one casualty of that is conversation, which also takes place at higher frequencies, as do bird calls. One of the things we found, though, is that what we in our culture attribute to age is often hearing loss that's induced not by aging, but by the environment and by constant exposure to noise. I think one thing older people can do is help younger people to experience silence as one of their choices and quiet. Not that they want to be quiet all the time. Who wants kids who are quiet all the time? But to know that such a thing as quiet exists.
All right. To Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Good morning, Malka.
Good morning. I had a thought when you were talking about children that have ADD and their exposure to noise. The thought that I have is that I've noticed that kids from autism spectrum or adults as well, people have thought disorder and anxiety disorders, tend to not be able to separate noise, that it's all one, and it really severely disturbs them. And I wonder if there's been any studies about that, and anything that could be done about the noise level to help them focus more and to not be, to be more productive.
Yes, there's been research of both, systematic and there's also anecdotal evidence to suggest that people on the autism spectrum, many of them are especially sensitive to noise and to other stimulation, tactile or odors or whatever. The leading animal psychologist and advocate Temple Grandin, who is on the autism spectrum and writes about autism, tells about how her nanny or whatever, when she was young, kept a supply of blown-up balloons on the top of the fridge. And whenever little Temple was being naughty, popped them. And Temple said that was just like having, an electric drill in her head or something like that. One of the things I think that we can recognize is that people with disabilities, especially kids, often serve in their classes and their communities as canaries in the mine. So people look at the autistic child and say, or the child with autism, I ought to say, and say, well, that kid just can't deal with noise. Chances are that kid is just suffering at a more acute level what other children are also suffering, and creating a better environment for that child in the home and in the school would affect others positively as well.
I hope that helps, Malka. Thanks for calling. Let's go now to Indianapolis. Hi there, Kenny.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professional musician, and I do a fair amount of recording and sound production and stuff. So sound and its effect on people is really interesting to me. I heard a show on NPR a number of years ago about ambient noise, the noise that of appliances and computers in work situations and home situations that we're often not even aware of until it maybe disappears in a power outage or something. But the effect that all those different tones of hum, if they clash, can have an effect on people's mood, on people's state of mind. And if there are fewer of them, or they are tonally in such a way that they are not discordant, that has a more positive effect on mood, or less of a negative effect. And I wondered if you've heard of those studies, or if that's it was fascinating to me, because this is something we all deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Sure.
Yes, there have been some studies that indicate that people are influenced, their moods can be influenced by certain tones, something that musicians like yourself and composers have known for a long, long time. The idea of the Mad King being pacified by a harper reflects that. One of the casualties, of course, of having so much ambient noise is music itself. And I've heard a number of musicians say that people are losing the ability to listen to music, and that in an age of recorded and amplified music, the musician as a physical presence that we are proximate with and have a relationship with is being lost.
Thanks for calling, Kenny, to Raleigh, North Carolina. And to Sardar, you're on the air.
Diane, this subject that you have taken today is touches the very fundamental issues concerning human life on this earth. And the way you described the couple enjoying, I was very much touched by that, how they experienced that silence. And there's a relationship between silence and sound. Only a silent mind can enjoy the sound. But unfortunately, the human mind now is not silent, because constantly there's a thinking going on inside. And that thought process is constantly producing noise. And the human being, the mind, when we get disturbed by that noise that is produced inside by our own tensions and anxieties and so many worries and all that, we want to avoid it. In order to avoid it and to curb it, we seek entertainment.
It's interesting as he talks about the quiet of the inner mind. Meditation is something that people turn to for that kind of quiet.
Absolutely. And I think as maybe one benefit of a noisy world is that we seek that inner quiet as a balm against the noise. I do always want to caution people against the idea, though, that if they only calm their inner mind, noise won't bother them. The Buddha, I imagine, had a pretty calm inner mind, and yet he told his disciples from time to time that they were making too much noise.
So from the research you've done, what are some of the strategies people can use to kind of tone down the noise, to deal with the noise that's going on around them?
There are many, and some are, of course, technical. They come from science. Some are legal. Some are cultural. And that's one of the things that drew me to the subject of the wide array of solutions that can be brought to bear here, or at least mitigation strategies. If I could say only one thing, I would say the best noise fighting strategy is getting to know your neighbor. before the noise problem begins, that will do a few things. It will mean you're probably going to be more considerate of your neighbor and your neighbor of you. It means the way you hear the neighbor's sounds and the way your neighbor hears yours will be interpreted differently. It won't be, who's that punk kid racing that car again? It's, there goes Bobby, and I remember when Bobby was only 4 years old. Bobby's car may still get a little too loud, but it's going to sound differently. And finally, when you have a problem like the woman with the neighbor with the frequency device, as she said, you know people that you can join with in seeking a larger solution.
Garrett Kaiser, his new book is titled The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. And I want to thank you for coming here today to talk about this. It's something we're all more and more aware of. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones.